from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The picture said it all. Liberal lion Chuck Schumer, arm-in-arm with John McCain, following the Senate's immigration vote yesterday. And it wasn't the only odd pairing of the week. Take the allies on either side of the Supreme Court's Proposition 8 and DOMA decisions. Or that following the Senate's bipartisan embrace over immigration, House Speaker John Boehner announcing that only a Republican majority bill would be considered in the House. And then there's the Supreme Court invalidating a hallmark piece of civil rights-era legislation in the same week the nation's first black president visits the gateway to slavery on the coast of Africa. A week of big stories and big contrasts. We'll put it into perspective after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. There are weeks when nothing much happens, and there are weeks when so many big stories happen they push each other out of the way like beefy football linemen battling for position. So went this week. The gay marriage rulings, the immigration vote in the Senate, Snowden still on the run, the court's ruling on affirmative action, presidential action on climate change, a filibuster creates a new liberal hero in Texas, the court again ruling on voting rights this time, all capped by an iconic photo of the nation's first African-American president standing at the ancient gateway to slavery in Senegal, the door of no return. It all happened this week, and in this hour of forum, we try to put it in perspective. Joining us to do so, Bruce Cain, professor of political science and director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West at Stanford University. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from Public Radio International, which premieres on KQED Monday at 12 noon. Todd, good morning.
Hi, Dave.
And joining us as well, Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Susan Davis, good morning, too.
Good morning.
Well, let's begin with the subject of immigration, since that's the most recent of all of these stories crowding their way into this current week. And to set the stage, let's listen to Senator Marco Rubio, who spoke on the Senate floor just before the vote.
We are not afraid of people coming in here from other places. Instead, inspired by our Judeo-Christian principles, we Americans have seen the stranger and invited them in. And our nation has been blessed for it.
Marco Rubio voting right before the vote on the Senate floor on Thursday. Todd Zwillick, there was a lot of bipartisan embracing after that vote. Everyone from Chuck Schumer and John McCain to Lindsey Graham and Bob Menendez. And now where will that embrace go now that it's the House's turn?
Yeah, that's right. It goes right to the House, where bipartisan embraces in the Senate generally, Dave, go to die. And that's exactly what's going to happen with this immigration bill, which is not to say it's a waste of time, because it's not. They put down a marker. Chuck Schumer and the other architects of this deal said they wanted 70 votes. There was a lot of bending and a lot of legislative dealing and even some buying going on to get to 70. They got close. They got to 68, which is not a bad showing for a major policy shift. But what happens when it goes to the House? Look, John Boehner, the Speaker, has made this clear. He is under enormous pressure in the classic way that we've seen time and time again for the last couple of years between the party establishment and the rest of conservatives. Look at it another way as sort of a microcosm, Dave, of the Republican Party. And this isn't new. This goes back to the administration of George W. Bush when he tried to do immigration reform in 2007 and even before. The struggle in the Republican Party right now between what I'll call the corporatists, the Chamber of Commerce backs this bill. The manufacturers back this bill. Agribusiness wants this bill. Major Republican constituencies. There's the corporatists, the Mitt Romneys, the George Bushes, the John Boehners, perhaps, of the world. And there's the nativists. That's what they are, a huge strain of House conservative Republicans that have no interest in a pathway to legalization or citizenship. And that's why the Senate bill is going nowhere. And that's why people like the George Bushes and the Mitt Romneys and the Lindsey Grahams and the John McCains of the world look at the 2012 election results, when Republicans lost by 38 or 40 points in the national election and say, we can't be nativist. If we are, we have no chance in 2016. Latinos are growing. Right now, they hate our brand. This is key for us. And there's a huge swath on John Boehner's right that just doesn't care in their districts about that dynamic. And that will govern what kind of bill, if any, they can get. One thing that we do know is that it will not be the Senate bill as passed with 68 votes just this week.
And does that mean then, Susan Davis, that the only real election that matters are in House Republican primary elections where there is a concern about if they were to support something like this, that they would be a challenge on the right? Is that really now where the action that matters most?
Yes. I mean, politically speaking, you cannot underestimate how different the realities are in the Senate and what happened Friday, or excuse me, on Thursday, and the political realities that face most Republicans in the House. Every 10 years, they redraw the congressional districts. And the last time they did this in the 2012 elections, House Republicans drew themselves into districts that are whiter, less diverse, and more conservative than they were 10 years prior. And the average the Republican district is about 12 points more conservative than the nation as a whole. And for the most part, about 80% of House Republicans represent districts that will never face a general election threat, that no Democrat really stands a chance at winning in these seats. So about 8 out of 10 Republicans are more likely to face a primary threat than a general election threat. And immigration reform, as Todd has just explained very clearly, is a very divisive issue within the Republican Party. Now, Democrats also tend to represent districts that Republicans cannot win in, but the issue of immigration has been much more broadly supported among Democrats. Democrats in the House represent much more diverse districts. They represent more Hispanics. And as a party, they have not faced the same kind of intra-party threats that we've seen on the Republican side of the aisle in the past two or three election cycles.
Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. So Bruce Kane, as someone who has just come back from spending a lot of time in Washington and who studies the way in which government works, what do you take from this? Do you see some sense or hope that actually there could be some bipartisanship in the future given what just happened in the Senate? Or is that going to perpetually be trumped by what we've just heard about how the House will proceed?
In the short run, I think I share the pessimism that we've heard so far. I think the dynamic inside the House is such that Boehner has to worry about keeping his job. And as long as he's holding on to the position that he's only going to go where the majority of the majority want to go, he's kind of boxed himself into a corner. I mean, I think, remember that you had, 14 votes on the Senate from the Republican side for the immigration bill. So it's a divisive issue within the Republican Party. But if you combine the Democrats in the House with enough votes on the Republican side in the House, you could possibly get approval of the Senate bill. But he just can't release the votes and let people take a free vote because it violates that majority of the majority, and it undermines the same dynamic that would keep him as Speaker. So that's why I think in some sense it's temporary. I mean, we're going to be stuck in this kind of netherland of sort of partisan immobilization until such time as we get a real jolt and one party or the other gets control of the government. And particularly, you know, if the House were to switch, you know, maybe you'd start to see some movement. But nobody's predicting that. We think that most likely in the next election is we'll go back to the pattern we saw before 2006, where not enough seats swing to really change control of the House of the Senate.
It sounds like, Susan Davis, that really there isn't anything that would alter that dynamic. I mean, Lindsey Graham said, I think yesterday, that we've now militarized the border, you know, 20,000 new agents, 700 miles of fencing to go up. A lot that you would think more conservative Republicans might like. But it doesn't sound like there's really anything that's going to sort of push that in a direction where some sort of bipartisan accord could be accomplished.
I don't doubt that comprehensive immigration reform can pass the House. I just don't believe that the Republican leadership in control is willing to do what they have to do to pass that bill. And part of that is I do think that the Speaker, if he wanted to, could bring a bill to the floor, not exactly the Senate bill because the House will have a say in this, but that would could pass on the strength of Democratic votes. And he has made very plain and very clear that he is not going to do that. And I'm not sure that his party would let him do that. And if he were to do it, his own place in the House could be very much jeopardized, if not immediately, certainly in the next Congress. Republicans, though, don't really have much, in the House at least, political pressure to pass this. As we've discussed, the incentive is the opposite. I do think, and what Lindsey Graham and John McCain and others have talked about, is it may take another wake-up call of an election. And they maintain, and it remains to be seen, but they maintain that if this fails and Republicans in the House are seen as the hurdle to that, then Republicans can kiss the prospect of a Republican in the White House in 2016 goodbye.
Hmm.
And Lindsey Graham has made a case, and there's historical precedent, that you know there's a certain amount of fatigue when you have a president of one party after two terms, and that the environment in 2016 could be ripe for a Republican presidential candidate. But if they cannot get past this issue, it's going to only get increasingly harder for Republicans to expand their national coalition. And what we have seen, and it's not just Hispanics. I mean, remember that this debate, we speak a lot about the Hispanic voter in America, but it also touches to a lot of just swing and independent voters who have thoughts about the immigration system. And I think one of the dangerous debates, one of the dangerous areas we may see in the House is sort of the tone of this debate and comments made by members in the party that they're not only trying to appeal to Hispanic voters, but also not offend them. And I think that it's one of these very tricky social debates where the rhetoric that has come from some elements of the party is not only alienating to Hispanic voters, but alienating to people that do not share those views. As Lindsey Graham said this week, he thinks that conservatism sells, but you can't get past the – you can't get the, them to listen to the argument if they think they're going to deport grandma.
Yeah. Hmm. Let's turn our attention now to where so much of this week's news was made, and that's in the Supreme Court. And joining us for this part of our conversation, Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal and author of a new book called The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Marcia Coyle, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be with you.
So let's go around once first on these important, different, interesting decisions the court made this week on everything from voting rights to affirmative action to, of course, the cases involving gay marriage. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, so much attention, not surprisingly, was focused on the two gay marriage decisions, particularly the one having to do with Proposition 8. But Marcia Coyle, which of those of that array of decisions that the court made this week, which do you think is the most significant, the one that will have the most lasting impact on America? Life?
I would probably point to the court's ruling striking down Section 3 of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. I know it's maybe a little premature to say, it's the one that will have the most lasting impact or influence, because we really don't know what the Supreme Court's going to say down the road if confronting head-on a question about whether there is a constitutional right to marriage for same-sex couples. But there was enough in that decision that I think that is where the court is headed, and certainly that seems to be where the country is headed in its feelings about the issue. I think the voting rights decision will be very significant as well. And I think that's more immediately significant in the sense that the states that have been covered by Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act are right now free to do what they want to do in terms of changing voting practices or policies. Unless Congress steps in, we may see a return of second generation or a continuation of second generation voting discrimination, which could be extremely harmful to the country down the road. So much depends on Congress when it comes to the Voting Rights Act. So it's a tough question to answer.
Well, let's pursue these cases and their significance. Todd Zwillick, starting with you on the sort of congressional reaction and whether or not, as Marcia suggests, that the decision in the Defense of Marriage Act represents a tipping point, a sea change in the way in which not only the country views this issue, but perhaps those in Congress as well.
Well, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act case was one that Congress had a direct hand in because it was the House Republicans that were defending that statute after the Obama administration through the Office of the Solicitor General refused to do so. It's usually the sitting administration that defends statutes. That's why the Solicitor General office exists, essentially. And they said, we're not going to defend the constitutionality of DOMA anymore, even though it was a Democrat, Bill Clinton, who signed it into law. So it fell to House Republicans who felt a couple of things on the face of it. One, if the administration's not going to defend a statute that Congress passed, we're going to defend it. And clearly that House Republicans felt like they are still the standard bearers of the attitude of their political base, which is largely against gay marriage, even though those numbers are shifting and shifting drastically. So the DOMA decision had a direct effect on House Republicans, and they had very little to say after the decision. One of the clear things that they did say is, we disagree with the decision. We look forward to a lasting debate on this in the states, which is to say, hey, Mississippians, Alabamians, whoever else, if you live in one of the majority of states that does not legalize gay marriage, this decision does not say that you have to accede to it, and we're going to try to make sure that you don't. Now, keep in mind, Congress doesn't pass marriage law. They tried in DOMA and failed to a degree, but you know, Congress doesn't really have say over marriage law in the states. And leaving that for a second, I think the other case from this week that had a big impact and really sort of rattled some cages around Congress was the voting rights decision. Sue Davis mentioned safe congressional districts and gerrymandering and all the other ways that state legislatures methods they use to solidify congressional seats and make sure that a lot of these races aren't close, aren't interesting, and frankly, sometimes aren't Democratic. It happens on both sides. In the case of the Voting Rights Act, in the cases that had prior review, those states are almost exclusively, if not exclusively, controlled by Republicans. So in this case, it's a Republican issue. Nationally, of course, it's not. And the voting rights decision really set in motion, allowed states that had controversial or before the decision, in some cases, illegal potential voting laws, voter ID laws or different kinds of voting restrictions, allow those to go forward. And they probably will be able to go forward now that Section 5 has been invalidated by the Supreme Court. And members of Congress and the campaign committees take notice of that. And those seats that are safe for one party or the other probably become even more entrenched. And you can bet that Democrats, especially liberals, who are trying to gain footholds in some of those places, see their job as a lot more difficult now.
And I want to circle back to the gay marriage decisions in a moment. But just staying with that for a moment, Susan Davis, do you see then the potential impact of the voting rights decision as something that will have a direct impact then on the 2014 and 2016 elections?
Well, it depends. I think what's interesting about the Voting Rights Act and that the idea of how they redraw the lines in minority districts, that already happened. In 2012, the Obama White House, the Obama Justice Department, was not particularly aggressive in reviewing the states that have traditionally been held to these standards. And for the most part, in a lot of these states that have been affected, what they have done is they have created minority-majority districts. And a lot of those districts were drawn by Republicans. And the idea was they're perfectly fine with having a very, very, very strong Democratic district and coordinating minorities into one district versus having more districts that are more competitive. So in some ways, that's already happened. But where it has more of an interesting effect going forward, because we're not going to redraw the lines again for a decade, and in places like Texas, they don't have to seek that review anymore, are things like voter ID laws on things that actually affect how people get to the polls and how they do that is more likely how we might see this play out in 2014 and 2016. Congress has the right, and Chief Justice John Roberts encouraged them, to go back to these preclearance standards and modernize them in the sense that the world has changed a lot since 1965, and not that racism doesn't still exist, but that they need to to have more modern data and modern standards, which sounds great. But in the idea that a Democratic-controlled Senate and a Republican-controlled House could come to terms on which states require preclearance and which ones do not, I'm highly skeptical they'll be able to find agreement on that. It does not mean they're not going to try. Pat Leahy, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is going to hold hearings later this month. Democrats in the House and John Lewis, who's a civil rights icon, said that they are going to try and organize around the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which is this August, and there's going to be a lot of commemorative events around that, to try and build a public groundswell of support. But it is hard to see how this Congress in this environment is going to do anything to address the preclearance issue and the Title IV that was struck down.
Sue Davis, chief congressional reporter for USA Today. Bruce Kane, what's your view on the gay marriage decisions, the DOMA case, as well as Prop 8, and whether or not we are now at a tipping point in the country?
Well, I'll answer that, but since I've written extensively and litigated under voting rights...
Everyone wants to talk about voting rights. Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, I just wanted to make a point that was left out, which is there is still a Section 2 protection. And so the...
And what is that?
Section 2 is a different provision of the Voting Rights Act that allows litigants to go into court under a series of tests that have developed over the last 20 years... After the lines have been drawn or after a procedure has been put into place, if you believe there are discriminatory effects, then you can go in. So the difference is a preclearance bar says, make a change, we'll tell you whether the change is okay. It matters. That's a very hard standard to deal with. But there's still make a change. If plaintiffs don't like it, they'll take you to court and then they can sue you. And that's a lot of money. A lot of jurisdictions don't want to pay that money. So, Section 2 is still alive and well.
Okay, so voter ID questions, yeah, photo ID could still be challenged. Yeah.
Yes, there'll be challenges under 14th Amendment under Section 2. So it's not as if the voting rights community has no tools. It's just that this one saved a lot of time and effort because it allowed the government to pre-clear things rather than now the groups are going to have to monitor where the violations are and decide where strategically to bring their lawsuits and how much money to put into them. So it changes the strategy drastically. As for the DOMA case, yes, I mean, I think we do need to come back to that because it is extremely important. I mean, it's just amazing. And I think of myself when I was asked on your show and other shows, you know, maybe 8 years ago, whether Gavin Newsom was doing the Democratic Party in the 2004 election, whether we could win, because Gavin Newsom did what he thought was right, even though everybody in the party was telling him that he was basically undermining the party's prospects in 2004. And look where we've come right now. And the fact that it's also recognized in the Supreme Court, I think is a huge thing. But the problem is, how does it play out at this point? Because traditionally, the state federalism, has been something the Republicans have embraced, you know, states' rights and state sovereignty. Now you're starting to see in the Democratic Party and in progressive circles people talking about kind of rights federalism, that we're not going to solve all these big issues nationally. So what we're going to do is let people vote with their feet and go to the states that are progressive in terms of their rights. But we're beginning to now see the complexity of that, because you're going to have gay couples who are in states that don't recognize gay marriage, and you know how that all works out, and it may indeed in some cases impact their federal rights, because there's a state component to that. I think we're going to see a lot of litigation, and that's going to be, I think, the initial place where we see the contrast between rights federalism, i.e. every state has its own sort of theory of rights, versus the sort of universalism of equal protection logic, which says, well, wait a minute, you can't treat people in one state who are in the same situation as people in another state differently. You just can't do that. And
let me hold you there if I might, Bruce, because we have to cut away to a break, and we have to say goodbye to Susan Davis. So, Susan Davis, I know you have to leave us. Thanks so much for being part of our program during this half hour. And when we return, we'll continue our conversation about the Supreme Court as well as all of the other big stories of the week. That's next on Forum after this short break.
Today is a great day for American children and families. Sandy and I want to say how happy we are, not only to be able to return to California and finally get married, but to be able to say to the children in California, no matter where you live, no matter who you your parents are, no matter what family you're in, you are equal.
That was plaintiff Chris Perry speaking after the decision on Proposition 8 this week in the United States Supreme Court. We continue our discussion of the Supreme Court's decisions this week, as well as the rest of the news of the week, with Bruce Kane, political professor of political science, rather, at Stanford University, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, which premieres on KQED Monday morning or Monday at noon, and Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. We welcome your thoughts on the news of the week, as well with the Supreme Court decisions, as well as all of the other important stories that took place this week. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Marcia Coyle, this was a week when we were reminded again of, the effectiveness of the person who you've just written a book about. That's the Chief Justice, John Roberts. Can you make an argument that John Roberts is the most effective politician in the United States today?
I'm sure he would not want to be characterized that way. No, I don't think I would say that, because I think from the decisions we saw this week that also Justice Kennedy continues to play an extremely important role. I wanted to pick up on what Bruce ended with before the break about the federalism and equal protection aspects in Justice Kennedy's DOMA decision, because he really was right on there. The thing about Justice Kennedy's DOMA decision and what made it sort of an incremental step for the Supreme Court was that it was this weird hybrid of striking down Section 3 on the basis of states' rights and the guarantee of equal protection in the federal Constitution. I have no doubt after the oral arguments in DOMA and maybe even in Prop 8 that the court's four moderate to liberal justices who joined Justice Kennedy in the DOMA decision would have rested that decision on equal protection due process grounds, which for Justice Kennedy meant if he did that, then it would be very difficult to sustain state bans on same-sex marriage. On the other hand, if he rested it entirely on federalism principles, states' rights, he wouldn't have been able to strike down Section 3. So it was a weird hybrid of the two, and not your typical opinion tackling discrimination against a group of persons. So I think Bruce made some very good points there, and that is why we're not quite sure how this is all going to play out, because the court really didn't take a stand on the gut issue here. So I think Kennedy still, you know, he's very influential. He's the one who often determines on equality questions, not only the outcome of certain cases, like he was a key vote in the voting rights decision, but also how far or how fast the court's going to move in certain areas, as he was key in the DOMA case.
Marcia Coyle.
So I think his influence is pretty important right now, just as Chief Justice Roberts now has 5 votes to move the court on certain issues close to his heart. And one of those issues clearly is race and the elimination of racial classification.
Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. Maybe I should amend my my comment about Chief Roberts to include Anthony Kennedy as the other most effective politician in Washington. Todd Zwillick, the court, as Marcia Coyle suggested, hasn't gone all the way on this issue and didn't go all the way on the affirmative action choice. In some ways, just sort of held on that and sort of handed it back. What's been the kind of Washington reaction to the affirmative action decision by the courts this week?
Well, very little, I have to say, except in some of the quarters where you might expect some of the, you know, ethnic caucuses of the House. There's the Congressional Black Caucus, Hispanic Caucus, of course. These groups had things to say about the decision. Pleased, I will say that while they did hand it back, they didn't strike down the constitutional acceptability of affirmative action, which is something that a lot of advocates feared. But, you know, again, this is an area of law that Congress is largely out of these days. These are tend to be state laws or even policies at state universities. And Congress and politicians kind of watch these things as cultural touchstones. They certainly have opinions about it, but let's face it, they don't run on it. There's very, very little by way of policy that gets passed out of Congress having to do with affirmative action these days. So, you know, particularly for members of Congress who either belong to or represent districts with a lot of underserved groups, ethnic minorities and otherwise, take an interest probably in constituent service in decisions like this, but not so much in a legislative sense. On the DOMA decision, on the other hand, and we keep coming back to this, I was just struck by what Marcia Coyle had to say, and a lot of people in Washington are wondering about the practicality of this with Justice Kennedy's decision on equal protection grounds partially. A lot of people now are walking around in the couple of days after they've sort of sobered up or digested the decision thinking, well, in 8 years or in 10 years, aren't we going to be right back here when a gay couple that lives in a state where gay marriage remains illegal, let's just for the sake of argument say Mississippi, you know, moves there from Vermont. They're right. Married legally in Vermont. They move down to Mississippi. All of a sudden, their marriage effectively is invalidated. Their tax status invalidated. They don't get Social Security anymore. Because right. Even though DOMA protected them, the DOMA decision protected them in Vermont, their marriage is invalid in Mississippi, that couple's going to sue and that couple's going to have a case. And from what I understand, and Marcia's the expert and Bruce is the expert, that case is coming.
Well,
and
we heard
in Washington think it's coming.
Well, we heard it come from two different perspectives. Marcia Coyle, I think this week, Justice Scalia raised that very example. And then President Obama yesterday said his view was that if you're married in Massachusetts, you're married anywhere.
Well, you're married anywhere for the purpose of federal benefits. That's what President Obama's hoping for. But it's still very murky, and you're right. Justice Scalia, in his dissent in DOMA, said that there was plenty of language in Justice Kennedy's opinion, and here he's referring to the federalism part of the ruling, to arm those who want to defend state bans on same-sex marriage. Also point out Chief Justice Roberts in his dissent seemed to feel that this was a federalism decision. So I think, you know, we're not in the clear at all yet on this.
Let's take a couple of calls. We have some calls about the Supreme Court's decisions this week. Chris in Oakland has a question. Chris, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hello, Bruce. I worked with Bruce on several redistrictings over the decades when he was at IGS. My question is about a case that sort of got buried by these more important and dramatic cases. It's about, I think it's called Koning, and it has to do with property rights, and it's going to dramatically limit what local jurisdictions can do in terms of conditioning development. And I wonder whether folks have thoughts about that.
Marcia Coyle, you have to leave us shortly, I know. So why don't you take that one on, please?
Well, he's absolutely right. It was lost in the final decisions of the week. And you know, it's strange because I sat through the oral argument. It was Kuntz. And this was a landowner who wanted to develop his property. He applied for a permit, and the local government first wanted him to dedicate part of the land to preserve wetlands on the land, and he wouldn't do that. And so then the local government said, well, if you would give us X number of dollars, or you would use X number of dollars to purchase other property that can be used, not his own property, but other property that can be used to preserve wetlands, you know, we will grant you the permit, because the local government was trying to maintain, preserve wetlands from development in the area. Well, the owner refused to do that as well, and so the local government denied the permit. And what the court here said, and what was surprising to me, because during our oral arguments, you had Justice Scalia saying, well, I don't see what the taking of property here was. What was taken? The permit was denied, so the government didn't take anything. But the court came out with a decision that said that a doctrine called unconstitutional conditions that had been applied when there actually was a taking of property by a local government that, say, conditioned a permit on the landowner creating maybe a bike path or whatever, also applied when a permit is denied, and also applies not just when property, land is taken, but when money is an exaction. So it's an extremely important decision to local governments in how they're going to be able to control development.
And Chris, thank you for the call. And Marcia Coyle, thanks so much for joining us. I know you have to leave us. Thanks for being with us. She is the chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal and author of the new book, The Roberts Court, The Struggle for the Constitution. Marcia Coyle, thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Let's move on to some other subjects that took place this week. The president announced some decisions that he was going to act on climate change, Todd Zwillick. And I'm curious about it because I want to try out again my interest, I guess, in what this week is telling us about how government works, because we see not much happening in Congress. We see the court acting. And this seems to be one other way that action takes place, which is by executive action only.
And there are several reasons for that. One is Congress. Look, the White House tried back when Democrats controlled the House for climate change legislation. Not only did it not pass, but a lot of Democrats blame that vote for their loss of control to John Boehner and the Republicans. Nancy Pelosi whipped that climate change, that cap and trade vote, to within 5 or 6 votes that she needed. She forced a lot of rank and file members to take a tough vote for the team. And to use another metaphor, they feel like they walked the plank. A lot of people, moderate Democrats, felt like they lost their districts long before Obamacare ever came around because of the climate change vote that Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama made them take. So look, there is no consensus in Congress for cap and trade or any significant climate change legislation. And indeed, one of the parties has as one of its tenets the notion that climate change isn't a real problem. And certainly you don't need to control it by controlling fossil fuels. So the White House saying that it's going to go around Congress is understandable because there are no votes in Congress for something like this. If they want to do anything and respond to their own base, Barack Obama is under enormous pressure from the environmental groups that support him and gave him votes and tons of money on his left, on the liberal wing of the party, to do something, try to do something. So doing what they can do by executive order or by administrative action isn't surprising. And they tried this once before. I don't know if people remember this, but the White House came up with the idea back a couple of years ago when they were trying for cap-and-trade climate change legislation to use the EPA and indeed use some Supreme Court decisions basically designating carbon a pollutant under the Clean Air Act that said the EPA may regulate carbon. Right. It is a pollutant under clean air. They used it as a cudgel. They said, Congress, pass something, have your say, take your votes, or else we're going to do it. You do it or we'll do it, but I'll bet you want to do it. That didn't work either, and they wound up in court. Here's the administration once again saying we're going to go after point source. We're going to go after coal-fired power plants. Of course, Republicans are calling that a war on coal. It may help them in some 2014 midterm election districts or states. That's probably true. And we should also understand that these executive actions from the administration aren't going to change anything at power plants tomorrow or next month or next year. They're all going to wind up in court. That's standard strategy in these battles. Industry takes the administration to court. It takes years over the legality of the decisions, and that's where we're going to be for a while.
Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Bruce Kane, just a quick political science 101 on this. Do you expect to see more of this, and what is it that allows the president to sort of take this kind of executive authority?
Well, I mean, the answer is that once a law is passed, it's got to be implemented and it has to be interpreted. So it then goes to the agency phase. and you know, how strictly they implement something, and whether they use regulatory incentives to try to get people to adopt new technologies. Even the exact wording of a regulation can be worth, you know, millions of dollars to give an industry. So what happens is, you know, industry starts to, as soon as a law is passed and it gets down to the EPA or these regulations are announced, you're going to have a flood of interest groups coming in, talking to the EPA, and then eventually, if they don't get their way, going to court. So it's a story about the legislative process that, you know, in the textbooks you had in grade school, laws were passed and
right.
They were simply implemented as they were passed, and it was all very clean. There was no politics after the legislature did its vote. But that's not really what happens. The politics and the fights that you saw at the electoral phase, that you see at the Congress phase, are continued at the regulatory phase, because they're in there with their lobbyists, they're in there with their lawyers, fighting tooth and nail over the wording, over the aspects of the regulatory policy.
Let's turn to a couple more stories from the week and also ask all of you on what you thought was the most important story of the week. If you'd like to contribute your thoughts on that, you can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Let's turn to the story of the famous 29-year-old, and let's let the president set the stage for us in his comments about Edward Snowden this week.
And I'm not going to have one case of a suspect who we're trying to extradite suddenly being elevated to the point where I've got to start doing wheeling and dealing and trading on a whole host of other issues. Simply to get a guy extradited so that he can face the justice system here in the United States. But let me, one last thing, because you asked a final question. No, I'm not going to be scrambling jets to get a 29-year-old hacker.
And it ties in with something Max writes us, Todd and Bruce. Max writes in, our common talking point this week is dismissing Snowden as a 29-year-old. David Brooks did that in his column. The president used the same line yesterday. Did the age of majority somehow move up to 30? Joe Biden was elected to the United States Senate when he was 29. Should millennials take this personally? Bruce Kane on the Snowden story.
What a great question. And I guess they should, because I think it is true that it's a metaphor for the kind of Wild West culture of the hackers and the Internet. And you do see it. I'm going to come across as old fogey, and I'll hear from all my Cal and now Stanford students about this one. But I would say that as a boomer, when you talk to these kids about privacy and, you know, property rights on the Internet, you're shocked that they have a very different view of the world, that they feel like, you know, things should be for free, like newspapers should be for free, and they feel that they're not as offended by some of these privacy considerations. But then you have the loner like Snowden, who is a libertarian, and you do run into more libertarians now than you did before. So I think there are images of this age group, and I suspect that's why 29 is a significant figure. But the guy turned 30, so they're not going to be able to do that anymore.
Exactly.
And Todd Swillick, you can sort of come at this from the first person as opposed to the third person, unlike Bruce and I.
Yeah.
Well, actually, less so than you might think. But Bruce beat me to it, because I was about to invalidate this entire discussion on standing, which is that the guy turned 30 a couple of days ago. So if the president were going to spare him the scrambled jets at 29, he's beyond that now. But I think the most interesting thing about this story, knowing what we know now, and maybe it's not a surprise, is a lot of the news media's willingness to concentrate on the leaker and not so much on the content of the leaks. And it is true that we had about a week of sort of, what do we know about the NSA and what do we know about Section 205 of the Patriot Act and what exactly is it that they're doing? But it has all turned to sort of personality-driven, sort of person-driven, whether he's a traitor or a leaker. I had a Senator Angus King, who's on the Intelligence Committee, on the Takeaway Today, who wanted to make sure everybody knew that he now thought that Snowden was a traitor and not something else. This is not the most relevant part of the story. And I'm seeing, you know, chyrons on cabled shows also kind of running their segments that say shutting down the leaks. Well, shutting down the leaks is a strange avenue into the story for a news organization. It should be, what did the leaks teach us and what do we need to know about whether or not the government is watching us, how much, and when? We did have that discussion for a couple of days, but it's pretty much gone now. And maybe that's poll-driven because Americans are comfortable with this. But this episode with Ed Snowden did bring up a whole bunch of other corollary issues that haven't been well vetted in the public, and some of them are very interesting. There's been some great reporting out of some of the Washington sort of boutique political press about how little members of Congress, and forget about rank and file members of Congress, how little members of the intelligence committees actually know about these programs. When they're briefed, they're briefed by people who often only answer specific questions they're asked. So if you don't know what to ask, you're not told. And a complaint from Senator Ron Wyden, which really got buried in a lot of this, he's a senior member of the Intelligence Committee. He's a Democrat and he's from Oregon. He knew about Section 205 of the Patriot Act, which is the Verizon phone metadata story. He knew about that years ago, and he wanted to legislate. He wanted to have a public debate. He wanted to bring up parts of it in an unclassified form. Not only was Ron Wyden not allowed to mention it on the Senate floor to have any form of public debate or constituent interaction, he wasn't even allowed to talk to a lot of his colleagues, most of his colleagues, about what he knew. And part of the story that's come out about this, and maybe it's parochial in Congress, but I don't think so, is how many members of Congress, even people on the intelligence committees, aren't allowed to know, and if they do know, aren't permitted to legislate on these key issues of privacy and security, these struggles that the president says we're struggling with or that he's trying to strike a balance in any meaningful way. And that's a major part of the story.
It is interesting in terms of what resonates, and I think you're exactly right in terms of what our focus has been on the Snowden case. And it actually brings me to the last story that I want to touch on briefly, because it is something that's resonated in the news media a lot this week. And that's been the story over the last 48 hours of Wendy Davis, the Texas state legislator who filibustered the anti-abortion bill that was before the Texas legislature. What do you make of that, Bruce Kane?
Well, first of all, you got to admire the physical capacity of this woman to sustain a filibuster under the conditions that she was under, you know, with no assistance and had to stay on topic. And you compare that to what Mr. Paul did in the Senate, and you realize that she really made an amazing sacrifice. So I think a lot of it was just that. But yeah, I mean, it really does two things. One, it reminds us that what we should do on the federal level is go back to making filibusters be truly filibusters, so mm-hmm. that people, because it gets more attention. I mean, there are thousands of filibusters, so to speak, implied filibusters going on every year in the Senate. We don't pay attention to it because it's all so routinized. Everybody's like playing chess. Well, if I object and to a filibuster, that we can't get enough votes to close it, so therefore we're not even going to go through all the motions. Whereas when we finally have a person that's willing to say, this means so much to me that I'm going to endure this physical pain to continue to make an argument on behalf of women's rights, I think that really restores what the meaning of the filibuster is. And I hope that sort of seeps out as well as people start to think about what we do in terms of Senate reform.
It's so interesting to think about this week in this perspective, that you have these contrasting events that would occur, Todd Zwillick, that you have the Wendy Davis story in the same week that you have the gay marriage decisions, that you have what's going on in the Senate with immigration compared to what's going on in the House, that you have the voting rights decision at the same time that President Obama is standing at the gateway to slavery in Senegal. It's just a reminder that while we may think we've tipped one way or the other, there's just so many contrasting forces in American political life.
It's very true, and it's also a reminder of just how easy it is to encapsulate weeks like this in 140 characters and just leave it at that. It's so very easy to do it on Twitter and just have one smart tweet about an entire week like this. And it isn't. And the Wendy Davis story in Texas was fascinating in this regard. In her long-windedness, and Bruce is right that it hit precisely towards what a lot of people are talking about in the Senate when they want filibuster reform. They are saying, forget about your politics. That's precisely the kind of filibuster mm-hmm. we want, that somebody has to jump up and talk about it. What's the corollary effect of this? Can Democrats put part of Texas in play? Not tomorrow, not next year. It's a very, very red state. But I saw Wendy Davis on television last night, and she gave a pretty interesting answer. It might have been MSNBC. I'm sure it was. She was asked if she wants to run for governor, and she didn't say, well, I have no plans for future office. I'm focused on the people of the 17th Texas senatorial district. She said, yeah, I do. And if people are excited enough about this and it lasts long enough, I'll challenge Rick Perry for governor. She just said yes. And so we'll see where it takes her. And this is the kind of thing, you know, Barack Obama gave one speech in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention and rocketed to stardom. Look where he is now. I can't know if that's going to happen with her, but it just takes one action that captures the country's attention, and you don't know where somebody's career is going to go.
I want to close by just reading this note from Ben, who writes, I want to share in the joy of the gay marriage ruling, but my head keeps reminding me that striking down the most vital piece of the Voting Rights Act is actually a bigger threat to me and to the country, and I hope that my LGBT brothers and sisters will reflect on that as well as the gains of the week. So with that thought in mind, just a quick thought from each of you on what you think is going to be, in the end, the most memorable story of this past week. Tough question, and now I'm going to make it tougher by saying you just have 20 seconds. Bruce Kane.
I come back to the gay rights. I mean, I think the listener is right that it diminishes the joy of the gains of the gay community to have their allies suffer a defeat. But it's still a very important victory, and it really does testify how far the country's come.
Todd Zwillick.
I think it's the DOMA decision that will have the most lasting effect. This was the first recognition on the federal level of a right to gay marriage. We don't know where that right is going to go, but it was a first and a major first. And when it comes to gay rights over the last 10 years, there's no question about it, Dave. This country has changed and changed quickly, and I don't think it's over.
Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, which again premieres on KQED Public Radio Monday at noon. Todd, thank you for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Bruce Kane, professor of political science and director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West at Stanford University. Bruce, welcome back to the Bay Area. Thank you.
Good to be back. Thanks, David.
Earlier, we were joined by Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal and Susan Davis of USA Today. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. Howard Zellman, our engineer. And Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.